Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. Hi, Larry Mueller here. We're talking about growing fruit trees with our guest. Back with us, Christelle Godeau, Associate Professor, Fruit Crops Entomologist and Extension Specialist in the Department of Entomology. Christelle, welcome back.
Thank you, Larry. Thank you, everyone, for being here. Happy to be back.
Well, it's great to have you back. Maya Atucha is an associate professor and fruit crop specialist. She holds the Gutchalk Endowed Chair for Cranberry Research in the Department of Horticulture. Maya, good to see your smiling face as well.
Thank you, Larry. Nice to see you too, and thank you for having us.
And we got a newbie with us today, too, Leslie Holland, assistant professor and extension specialist in fruit crops pathology in the Department of Plant Pathology. And Leslie, good to see you. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Pleasure to meet you and be with you all.
Well, I tell you what, and all three are located on the UW-Madison campus, by the way. So as we visit with them, what questions do you have about fruit plants, fruit trees? Join in the conversation. The number to call is 800-642-1234, or you could send us an email to ideas@wpr.org. Leslie, let's start with you. Tell us a little bit about your horticultural background.
Not too much in horticulture, definitely more in pathology based. So my background has been focused on canker diseases of both almond trees and grapevines. These are caused by numerous types of fungi. So they're usually the pathogens or the diseases that you don't always get to see, right? We always think of a lesion on an apple or a lesion on a leaf. I study those kind of very quiet pathogens that you don't think about until your tree all of a sudden is completely in decline. So...
Well, we don't want that to happen, so it's good to have you here to help us out a bit. Christelle, tell us about your work with fruit crop entomology.
So, Larry, one thing that we've been talking a lot about and we keep talking about is really those little insects or bigger insects that keep bothering everybody. And so generalist insects like Japanese beetle is one that we regularly every year talk about and have a lot of people have questions. What's the best way to manage them? What can we do? And my answer to that for the most part for homeowners is pick your battles, handpick your beetles, put them in soapy water, and, you know, have a nice walk in your backyard every day and handpick them. That's what I do. So really, that's what I recommend because there's not that much to want to do. And if people are interested in applying insecticides, then there's other things they can do. But for the most part, people tend to not really want to do that. And so that's the best approach that you can do. There's also plants you would want to avoid planting, right? So again, pick your battles. What do you want to do? Do you want to have a beautiful linden tree that in the month of July is going to be pretty much entirely defoliated? Or do you want to pick something like a mulberry? You know that I'm saying you should have a mulberry, but something that they don't tend to prefer. So there's also those kind of battles to pick, like see what they prefer and try to, either protect those or not really buy them.
Well, I know there's lots more we can talk about it, and I'm looking forward to it during the show. Amaya, I had some dried cranberries in my breakfast cereal this morning, so I thought about you. You could tell us about
your... I don't know how I feel people thinking about me when are in their cranberries.
Maybe you could talk with your work about fruits and maybe a bit about cranberries, your work with cranberries.
Sure. Well, Wisconsin, we're the top producer of cranberries in the world, so it makes sense that most of the research is done here in Wisconsin. I have to say, I'm not the only researcher working on cranberries. Just Christelle and Leslie and a lot of other colleagues here at UW-Madison work also in cranberry production, different aspects of cranberry production. But the work on cranberry is fascinating. As I say, it's one of the few institutions where we have such a strong research program, and we work on all aspects of whether it's irrigation, fertilization, how to understand how the fruit grows, what are the things that we can do to improve yields, have consistent yields, what can we do in terms of management to overcome climate change. And I mean, there's nothing like Wisconsin Springs to think about climate change. One year we're like full of frost. This year we had like 2 weeks of really warm weather. Then it got cold. Then it got hot. Then it got dry. Then it got wet. Now we have all this rain. It's just, you know, there's always something to be working on. Like we're not, there's no shortage of ideas for research in any fruit crop, which tends to be challenging because fruit crops are perennial crops. And so it's not that we plant them this year, we harvest them at the end of the season, we forget about them every year. That we need to, you know, we need to make sure to keep them healthy and to be able to, you know, withstand the winter and these crazy springs and still have a good yield and high quality fruit. So it's definitely challenging.
Well, it's challenging, but the three of you are here with some help for our listeners. Kathleen in Delavan has a question right off the bat. Let's go there. Hi, Kathleen.
Yeah, hi. I'd love them to talk about my favorite berry, which is aronias, and I am totally flummoxed why they've been so hot in Europe for so long, and we have virtually no understanding or promotion of the berries over here. And how are they promoting them now, and what research is being done?
All right. Who wants to talk about aronia? Amaya, let's go to you. Well,
it's
first,
true,
what are these berries?
Oh, aronias. Aronias are a small deciduous shrub. I think they're also called chokeberries, which I never knew them. They're from the rosacea family. They're same family, actually, as apples and a lot of other fruit crops. And they are, they're native for around this area. So they grow really well, and they have wonderful chemical components for promoting health. So they're these really dark, full of antioxidants berries, and so they're known for their health benefits. So there has been some research here at UW-Madison, especially in the Department of Food Sciences. That's where most of the work has been done, mostly looking at some of those health components. But the truth is that there's not an extensive research program for these types of berries. There has been a lot of small little projects here and there. I think one of the difficulties is that it's not a well-established fruit crop, so there's not established industry, and that limits, and a lot of people don't know this, about why do we do certain research and how do we get to do that research. Part of it is the funding that we have available and how we can get support to do the research, because we work at the university and we get our salaries, so we need funds to actually do the work. And so part of it is that we don't have a strong industry, aronia industry, that could, you know, help us obtain some of those fundings to do more research. So that's one of the reasons why we don't have it. And as I said, again, it's not a major priority, and we have so many other food groups in the state that we can only do so much. But there has been some work done, and there's some information. If you go through UW-Madison, the Division of Extension, there's some information that is published there, and I think we also have some in our news in our website, fruit.wisc.edu.
Christelle, you were going to add something as well.
Yeah, so aronia is, like Amaya said, it is an interesting fruit, and we've done a little bit of research because we have this little fly, spotted wing Drosophila, that attacks small fruit, and we had growers here. So again, like Amaya said, there's very few commercial growers, which really drives us with the research. And so one of the growers was really asking us, like, what's going on? Is that we're finding spotted wing Drosophila larvae, so those tiny little maggots, in our aronia. So we actually did end up doing a research project on it, based on just growers asking us to assess that the impact that this fly may have on aronia. And so long story short, really, it was just to say that there is a little bit of research here and there, but it's not, like Amaya is saying, very coordinated effort because there's so few growers and commercial production. But long story short, we found that those, you really want to protect those aronia when you're harvesting them, because then when you have them all harvested and they're destemmed, the flies can get into those berries, but not while they grow. And actually, the interesting point is that the flies that grew out of those aronia berries that we did in the lab some testing were very small and puny flies. So they didn't really like the aronia. But like any small fruit like that, it's fair game when they're kind of compromised, either destemmed or cracked or something like that. So just, you know, a little side note on Aronia.
Fun for there we go. Kathleen, thanks much for calling. Gail in Middleton will go to you. Hi, Gail.
Hello. Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a large raspberry patch. It's about 20 feet by 5 feet, and it's fenced because the rabbits feed all the raspberries. And lately, we've had it for almost 40 years, really. It's been there a long time. The plants look very healthy, but the raspberries are very small, and they fall apart. And not as much at all as what we used to get. We've fertilized it. We've mulched it. I don't know what to do. I'm wondering if I should rip it all out. I put a couple tomato plants in that same area, and they are doing fantastic.
Well, let's see. Who wants to take that? Amaya, you want to go ahead?
Sure, I'll take it. Well, it all depends on how old the patch is. It's true that at some point a renovation is needed to get better new canes that are more vigorous and get a better fruit set. So that might be one of the issues. The other issue I would also say, if you're having low fruit production, it might also be related with the way that you might be pruning them. And you didn't specify if these were summer or fall berries that you have on those raspberries. So the way that you're pruning them, especially if you're having fall berries, that you're making sure that you're cutting the canes really low to the ground level, so you don't have some of the lateral shoots from the canes from last year growing. Those tend to be less vigorous and they will have less fruit. That is definitely something that that could affect the number of flowers and the quality of the berries. Some other things, it's hard to diagnose without seeing them and not knowing much, but another thing that I would consider would be what happened during this year in the spring. You know, it seems to me like maybe those berries didn't get good pollination. It could also be that, you know, we had a very drought, like the drought and the very dry period that could also affect some of the fruit set. So maybe those berries didn't have all of the berries. You know, this the compound fruit, each one of those small little berries with the seed is actually one fruit. So if you don't have good pollination, you have, it's very hot and very dry, and the pollen might not be viable because of the heat. All of those things might be affecting it. I'm going to throw it out there, and I know we have Leslie here, but also viruses are something that affects over time. And in the years that I've been here in Wisconsin, I've had a lot of emails like this, and I always recommend, well, why don't you send a sample to the diagnostic, to plant diagnostic clinic to see if might be viruses, because that's something that is not unusual for raspberries. And the thing that you're saying, some of your berries are crumbling, it kind of, you know, raise a flag that it might also be related with viruses.
Yeah, Leslie, anything to add there?
Yep, I definitely second what Amaya said about getting those samples tested. I think there are a lot of other factors that can seem similar to virus, whether it's nutrients or too much water to not enough water, right? Those different things can kind of look very similar to viral symptoms sometimes, depending upon the plant. But I think a diagnostic assay would kind of help you determine if that was the case. So
makes good sense to me. We have three guests for you today: Leslie Holland, Christelle Godot, and Amaya Atucha, all fruit experts from the UW-Madison. And you can join in with your questions. Number to call, 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us. The email address is ideas@wpr.org. Jill Nadeau, our producer today, Lee Rayburn, our engineer. I'm Larry Wheeler. You're listening to the Ideas Network. Great to have you with us for this edition of Garden Talk. We're zeroing in on fruit plants, getting more from your fruit plants with our three guests today, Leslie Holland, Christelle Godot, and Amaya Atucha, all fruit experts from UW-Madison, and they cover a pretty broad range of things here. So you're going to be hard pressed to stump them, I think, when you call in. So give us a call, shoot us an email. Love to hear from you. Ann in Duluth, Minnesota has something for us. Let's go there. Hi, Ann.
Hi. Hi, this question is for you too, Larry. I've wanted a lime tree ever since I heard about your limey. And my daughter gave me two citrus trees last year. I killed one of them very quickly. So right now, I don't know if I have a lime tree or a combination lime, orange, lemon tree. But what I'd like to know is how to fertilize them. I bought an organic fertilizer, and it stunk so bad like dead fish, I almost had to vacate my house.
Was it fish oil? Was it a fish oil?
No, I had some fish, but I don't know. It just said it was for citrus trees, so I bought it and thought, well, you know, and I'm not kidding. The smell was unbelievable for 4 days, so I can't use that again.
Well, let's hear from our experts. I can throw in my two cents worth, too, but Amaya, we'll go to you, see what's on your mind there.
You know, if you, I mean, I wouldn't use fish emulsion in my house. I mean, I don't know, unless you're trying to be organic, that I would not try to do that. I think that, you know, the easiest thing is just to buy, like, even in my house, my own plants, I just don't buy anything special. You just go to the store, buy a fertilizer. Usually the fertilizers have three numbers that represent the amount of nitrogen, phosphorus, and potassium. So you're going to have something like, you know, 14, 14, 14. That means that the mix that you're buying has 14% of nitrogen, 14% of phosphorus, and 14% of potassium. Using those kind of fertilizers, you know, general fertilizer, anything that you can buy at a garden store would just work just fine. What I would say is start with small amounts. So maybe dissolve a teaspoon of the fertilizer in a gallon of water and use that to irrigate it. Maybe if you're irrigating, depending if it's now in the summer, probably your house is warm and you're getting a lot of sun to your plants, which is absolutely a must for growing citrus indoors. Just divide that amount in two irrigations. And then I would say just wait to see the reaction of the plant. Some are going to uptake it and you're going to start seeing new leaves right away. You don't want to over-fertilize them. You're going to have excessive amount of growth and not necessarily fruit. The more you fertilize her, the more vegetative the tree is going to become. So the less flowers you're going to have. And so the less fruit you're going to harvest out of it. So be careful with the amount of fertilizer. Only fertilize if you see that they're getting pale or you see some, your leaves are starting to get pale. You see some pattern that might resemble some nutrient deficiency. But if it's growing fine, you have good leaves and it looks green and receiving good light, it might just be that the soil that you have in the pot where you originally potted still has enough nutrients to supply to that tree.
Well, for limey, the lime tree that I have had, I use fish emulsion, but I use it every watering. And they need those fruit trees need a fair amount of water. And so I put a couple tablespoons, you know, I just slop in a little fish emulsion in the bottom of the water jar, which holds about a half a gallon of water, and I put the rest with water, and I put it on the soil, and it doesn't. I haven't had that many problems in terms of bad smell. It's usually gone pretty quickly when you're mixing it with a lot of water. So that's what I do, and I use it every single time I water. So I don't know, Amaya, go ahead.
It will depend on the type of product that you're using. If you're using something like, you know, fish emulsion or seaweed or any of those organic ones, they're going to have a much lower percentage of nitrogen and right. phosphorus and potassium than if you're using a conventional regular fertilizer. So it depends. If you're going to go in the route of putting something organic, even if you're putting some, you know, compost tea, they also have nutrients, but they have less concentration. So in that case, you might be required to put more to see the same effect that if you're going to use a traditional fertilizer. So both of them will work. Both of them will provide the same nutrients. It's just different quantities and also how easily accessible those nutrients are going to be to the plant. When you put something like, you know, fish emulsion, there has to be some breakdown of that fish emulsion for the nitrogen to be available for the roots to uptake it right away. Versus when you put a regular fertilizer, it just dissolves right away and it's there for the plant to be uptaken within, you know, sometimes 24 hours could be uptaken. So that's what I say. If you're putting something that is organic, might require more applications more often of small quantities. If you're applying something that is a conventional fertilizer, you might just have less application and less often because it's going to be more available.
Very good points. And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate your call. And Leslie, I want to turn to you a minute. You've mentioned before the show that you were getting some calls about fire blight on apple trees and also black rot on grapes. A couple of things. What do those look like and how do you control those?
Those are great questions. And yeah, it's been a very interesting year, as Amaya was alluding to earlier. We've had, you know, cold damage to a drought, and that was a very quiet period for most diseases. I think a lot of people were happy with maybe missing some rain, but not seeing any disease. And then I'd say within these last couple of weeks, we've really started to see a shift. So fire blight specifically for apple, things that you're probably going to be seeing now are going to be what are shoot infections. And so we call it fire blight because it looks like fire has come through a portion of your tree and burned up some of the leaves. So this is a really diagnostic symptom. Oftentimes we'll see some flag shoots where you just see a couple of branches that have completely burned. This is where the bacterium has gotten in and caused that infection. So in terms of trying to manage a disease like this, especially trying to prevent any spread to your apple fruits, is really removing the pathogen from the tree. And we do this through pruning. This is typically done through pruning out different branch, those infected branches, right? The secret or the most important part about this, especially with fire blight specifically, is where you're making pruning cuts. Oftentimes we see an infected shoot and we think we cut right at the edge where you see that the brown or the dead tissue end. You actually want to cut beyond that. You want to cut into the healthy tissue. I would say for most of our growers, anywhere between maybe 12 to 14 inches into the healthy tissue past that margin of infection, because that's going to ensure that bacteria is out of your tree and that it cannot continue to spread. That bacteria is quite systemic in trees. So if just because you're seeing symptoms in one portion and healthy tissue in another portion does not mean that bacterium is not necessarily in that portion of the tree. So we've got to kind of prune a little bit further back just to ensure that that infection doesn't spread. Something else, like you mentioned for grapes on black rot, hearing more about that, I think that has to do with some more of the rain that we're getting. And unfortunately, it's an unavoidable disease, I would say, for grape. So oftentimes it's, again, another great descriptor. You see a lot of black growth or discoloration on your grapes. And you also see growth of the fungus as well. And so sometimes you'll see tiny little black dots on the berries. And these are the structures of the fungus, which allows it to reproduce and spread to more grapes. So the best thing that you can do for this actually happens way back in the season before, and that's going to be sanitizing your grape, which means pruning off portions that are already infected and especially pruning off old grapes from that season that have shriveled up. They almost look like little raisins. I can assure you they're not raisins and they're not something you want to keep on your grapevine. You want to remove those because those are holding that fungus that's going to hold on all the way through the winter and make it to the following season and cause new infections. So sanitation is going to be your number one tool for something like black rot. But like I mentioned, it starts the dormancy before that following season. So a lot of planning when it comes to these pathogens.
Well, let's good points there. Let's take another call. Karen in Suring, we'll go to you. Hi, Karen.
Hi, Larry. Nice to be on your show. I have
Thank
a raspberry
you.
Question, and it has okay. to do with cane borers. We don't have a huge infestation. It just started last year. It's an old patch, and it probably needs rejuvenation. It's quite crowded. So what's our option, our strategy to deal with them?
And are those like fall bearing or spring bearing or summer bearing?
Well, my husband calls them everbearing, but they're fall bearing.
Okay. Christelle?
Yeah, well, thank you for your question. That's sometimes something we see. Cane borers in raspberries happen. They're pretty sporadic. They're not a major pest in raspberries. But when you see them, obviously, they will kind of girdle that part of the plant, and then that whole stem is going to be done pretty much. So the main thing you can do, and that goes back to what Leslie was saying before, is going to be, you know, making sure that you remove the part that's affected. So you want to cut that stem at the below those, you kind of have 2 points where they're cutting and laying their eggs in. You want to cut that out and get rid of it. That will be your best option for managing those. I wouldn't recommend any kind of insecticide or anything like that unless you really had a heavy infestation. But again, like I said, I've never seen one in Wisconsin. So I'm hoping that you're in the same case where you see some canes, where you have the cane borer in there. Just prune those out, get rid of them, and you should be good to go. I mean, raspberries produce a lot of canes, and so hopefully you're able to do that and not really lose that much out of your raspberries.
Okay, there
Thank
we
you.
Go.
We'll implement that immediately.
Okay,
thank
you. Thanks.
Happy
thanks,
to
Karen.
Help.
Oh, man. Jonathan in Boulder Junction, your turn. Hi.
Good morning. I'm wondering, I have a very healthy but barren blueberry bush at my campsite, and I'm wondering if it needs a partner or more than one partner to get it to bear fruit.
Amaya, what do you think?
No, it actually doesn't. The question would be, do you get flowers?
No. Just nice green leaves, but very healthy.
Well, that's your problem. If you don't have flowers, you can't have fruit.
So
this is actually a question that we get all the time about, why don't I have fruit? So for me, when you go to the doctor and the doctor asks you questions to try to figure out what's happening, here's the first question where that happens. When somebody tells me, I don't have fruit, well, we can go two directions. One is you don't have flowers. That's why you don't have fruit. Or you do have flowers, and those flowers are not setting a fruit. So in your case, you're telling me you have some really beautiful, long green shoots, very vigorous, and you don't have any flowers. Is that correct?
That is correct.
And so you've never had any flowers on those blueberry bushes? You've never seen any blossoms?
I have not.
And when did you plant them?
Oh, this is about 5 years old.
Okay. And so do you fertilize them a lot?
I use a fertilizer called Beat Your Neighbor.
Well, maybe
that's a heavy nitrogen one.
That's your problem. You're putting too much nitrogen into those bushes and you're getting a lot of vegetative growth, and that is inhibiting flower induction. So my recommendation to you is stop fertilizing.
Ah, okay.
Yeah, and soil acidity may be an issue as well.
But that doesn't affect flower induction.
No,
so a lot
no,
of people
doesn't.
Think that nutrition, especially fertilizer, is going to fix all of the problems of the plant. So something happens and everybody thinks it's nutrition. Actually, when we have nutritional problems, this is sort of it's a long process. It's really hard to see from 1 year to the other outrageous nutritional deficiency or toxicity. I mean, if you're dumping, 20 pounds of fertilizer, maybe you will. But it's a process that takes several years. And it's never that dramatic that you would not get any flowers. And so this is a case in which the problem is that it's too much fertilizer. You're encouraging too much vegetative growth, too many shoots, too many leaves. And by doing that, you are kind of like skipping that window of flower induction. For flowers to happen, there has to be terminal buds that have to set. And for that, there needs to be growth the growth needs to stop. Those shoots need to stop growing so that they can induce flowers for the following year. If you put so much nitrogen, what's happening is that those shoots keep growing and growing and growing and growing, and they miss the window of induction. Then the next year, you don't have any flowers. So here's my recommendation. Stop fertilizer. Next year, don't fertilize, and hopefully you'll get some flowers.
There you go, Jonathan.
All right, nothing but rain and plain water next year. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Finn in West Salem, we'll go to you. Hi.
Good morning. How is everyone today?
We are fine and ready to try to answer your question. What's on your mind?
Wonderful. 6 years ago, I put in a Reliance and a Contender peach tree. They were from a decent nursery. They were very well-started trees. And the first year, they grew very well. The second year, they kept growing. The third year, we got, I'm thinking roughly a bushel of peaches off of each one. Since that time, the fourth year, the trees seemed healthy, but they didn't flower. The fifth year, the one the contender started failing. Branches started to wither. It finally died away this year. The Reliance kind of was a little bit behind the other one, but it did the same thing. And I guess the only thing that I can think of is that there's a white fungus.
Yeah.
Otherwise, what would have caused these six-year-old trees to go downhill and die?
Well, they're peach trees, for one thing. Amaya?
Well, okay.
Amaya's may have a comment, though, on that.
Where did you say you were located?
West Salem, Wisconsin.
Okay, so growing peaches in Wisconsin is really, 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 really difficult. That's why we don't have a peach industry here. The first thing that comes to mind to me is just cold damage. What happens is that, you might have a mild winter and you have, wonderful growth and the trees look great. And then you get, you actually have flowers and you have fruit. But then you get a winter that is not so good. And then you have some cold damage. So some of the permanent structures of the tree are damaged. And then you have another winter and then a little bit more damage. And then you start adding that damage and then the tree collapses. And that is, it's the classic thing that we see with peach production here. It's very difficult to grow peach. You have the right cultivars. Actually, we do recommend those cultivars for Wisconsin. But cold damage, I mean, we have had brutal winters. I mean, the winter of the polar vortex that we had in the 2019 winter, that is just, peach trees cannot withstand that. So that probably is part of what you're seeing right now. The trees just are collapsing from cumulative damage during the winter. And then you have a really cold winter like the one we had like three winters ago. And then that just killed the tree.
Yeah, it's a hard... We've had questions about peach trees often on Garden Talk. And unfortunately, we're just not... you have to have a very... somebody's going to call and say, oh, I've got a peach tree I've had for 10 years. Sometimes it's the microclimate that you might have in your specific area that just keeps that peach tree growing.
Okay.
So there are...
It's protected in the winter.
Yeah, it's...
They did so well, and we were just tickled pink.
And you know what? This is something that we see with sometimes growers. Growers, they're like, oh, we want to plant peaches, and they plant peaches, and we tell them, don't do it, just don't do it. And they're like, oh, we did it, and we have this wonderful yield and these peaches, and we make so much money. But then the next year, you get a really cold winter, and when you said you protect them, unless you had it inside a greenhouse with heat,
sure,
they're still going to suffer cold damage because these are tender fruit crops. These are not fruit crops that are native from this area, so they're not able to acclimate to this point. And sometimes even when you might be able to survive the winter, you might not have any flowers because the flower buds are so sensitive, much more sensitive to cold damage than the trunk and the limbs. You're still not going to have any flowers. And so in addition, some of the cracks that happen in the bark in the winter with the really, really cold temperatures that we experience, or the swing of temperatures, are, great entrance for pathogens. And I'm not even going to get there because, peaches can get pretty nasty with canker diseases, as Leslie is nodding here. So I'm sorry that we sound so negative, but it's really tough to grow peaches. And I say congratulations for the year that you actually did get peaches, because not a lot of people do.
I guess I'll stick with buying Colorado peaches.
Yeah, I think you might be better off. Yeah, thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. Oh, my goodness. Jeremy in Manitowoc County, we'll go to you. Hi, Jeremy.
Hey, good morning. I just want to say it's always my favorite Larry Mueller show when the UW team is on. And I just want to say thanks to Amaya and Christelle and Leslie. And just to be sure to plug their Fruit News. That's a great resource.
Ah, the Fruit News newsletter. Tell us about it. Christelle, do you want to talk about that letter and how people can get it?
Sure. I'll be happy to do that. I just was saying thank you so much for the comments. That's very much appreciated. Yeah, we have this Wisconsin Fruit News that we've been putting together for several years now, and a Wisconsin Fruit website as well. So we are always happy to have people sign up for the newsletter or just check out the website. We try to put all the resources that we put together on that website. So there's really a wealth of resources from ourselves, but also from other universities and other extension people. So it's really a wealth of information. And you can go to fruit.wisc.edu. So again, fruit.wisc.edu. And that's where you can check out the website as well as sign up for the newsletter. And the newsletter only comes out in the summer, but really we start in usually mid-April all the way to pretty much October. And it's every other week that we send it out. And it's convenient now even for cell phones and things like that. So you can click on when you get the newsletter, it's different articles, the different links that you can click to. So you can kind of skim and only check the ones that you're interested in. So it's pretty convenient. And we're pretty proud of it. So.
Well, you should be. And thanks. Jeremy, thanks for bringing that up, because it's nice to plug that for sure. I want to put in another plug. We're partnering with UW-Madison's Extension Horticulture Program. To learn more about your experiences listening to Garden Talk, and we'd love to find out what you learn during the show and how you'll put it to good use, as well as your ideas for future Garden Talk topics. And we've gotten a lot of good ones when we've done this. You just need to go to WPR.org/Larry, WPR.org/Larry. Click on today's show note for a link, and you can fill out just a brief questionnaire. It'll take you a minute or two to fill it out. You could also type in go.wisc.edu/radio to any browser. It'll just take you a couple of minutes, and we hope you will do that and let us know what you're thinking. Okay. Leslie Howard, Christelle Gadeau, and Amaya Atucha, our guests today. You're listening to Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller for the Ideas Network. Great to have you along for this edition of Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here. We're talking about getting more from your fruits, from your fruiting plants, with our three guests from the UW-Madison, Leslie Holland, Christelle Gadeau, and Amaya Atucha, all fruit experts in one area or another. And if you have a question, join in. The number to call, 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234, or email us to ideas@wpr.org. Janice in Greenville has a question, so let's go there. Janice, thanks for waiting. What's on your mind?
Yes, thank you. See, I have a pear tree, and a deer ate about a foot up on it. It's a young one. It's only maybe a couple years old pear. But I was just wondering if I should cut it down and if I could resurrect it that way or put something over the wound. I mean, it ate down to where you can see the inside. It took the bark right off and a part of the interior, not too much of it. It's been scarring over pretty nice, but just looking for extra things I can do.
Did it go all the way around the tree or...
No, just one line down, and that was it.
Okay. Okay. Yep. Amaya, what do you think?
Well, if it's not all the way around and you still have some bark on the rest of I assume that this is the main trunk, you might still be able to save that tree. That tree will heal on that side, and then, you know, it should be able to produce new, what we call like the vascular tissue that you lost there. I would just be maybe like, I don't know, this is a question for Leslie, just maybe cautious that you have that open wound with all the rain that we have and how humid it is that you might get some disease. But I think that the tree should be able to survive. If you were going to prune it, what's going to happen is that, you know, we are mid-July. You're not going to have a lot of time to get new growth out of it, especially if you're pruning it down considerably. And so I would be worried that it might put some new shoots that are not going to harden for winter. So I think that the best strategy would be just keep it the way it is and just keep an eye on any possible diseases that might develop around there. Try to, you know, keep, you know, if you're no need to irrigate it with this weather, but if you've been fertilizing it, you know, maybe some fertilizer could help. But other than that, just wait and see what happens next year. You can always prune it next year if you see the tree is not recovering well. But I would think that because you didn't go around the entire bark, it's not like you have like a ring in which the deer produced the damage, it should be able to survive.
And Leslie, what should Janice be looking for? I mean, in the way of just paying attention to see if there's anything that may be developing in a bad way around that wound.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think fortunately it sounds like that wound healing process of the tree is going really well, which makes sense because it's young and that's what you would expect. So continue to do things, of course, to encourage that. But in terms of disease that you might be looking for, something like a canker would look darkened on the bark, often sunken in, which might be hard to differentiate if you've already got some of your tissue missing. So you're looking kind of for a darkened area in the tree around that wound. Alternatively, if you're dealing with something like a wood rot fungus, you're actually going to see that almost moldy growth on the outside of the tree. So keep an eye for any weird, perhaps kind of white to different colored growth on the outside of that tree if you're concerned about that. But it sounds like it's healing up good. So hopefully there won't be any of that.
Yeah, for sure. And Christelle, what about the bug side of things?
Yeah, so I was thinking too, like if you have deer damage, you might have it again. So you might want to consider putting some kind of a fencing around your tree to prevent more deer to come, because obviously that's something that in general, a lot of our commercial growers will do to prevent deer feeding. So something to think about. And then also, if you have insects that start developing, like I'm thinking about pear slugs or something like that, like insects that you, pear slugs are not insects, but whatever, you know, that you start seeing in higher number of pathogens, you probably want to protect that tree because it's going to be a little bit on the weaker side. And so you want to make sure that you'll protect it. If you start seeing any kind of insects or pathogen, I would recommend that.
Okay. Thank you, Janice. Appreciate it. Tina in Sharon, Wisconsin, your turn. Hi.
Hi. Good morning, everyone. Thank you so much for taking my call. Really quick call for you. I have peaches, and I was just listening to peaches being a very challenging thing to grow. Yes, they are. But I do have peaches right now on one of my trees. They seem to have, like, little tiny droplets, if you will, or little, I don't know, dollops of something very sticky. I'm wondering if that's not, like, a fructose or some type of sugar thing. Wondering what that is. The other thing is, I have pear trees. Are pears like the peaches, which are very challenging to grow? Not sure. The last two years, my pears are about the size of the palm of your hand, a little bit smaller. Maybe they could sit in there, but then they fall off. They don't come to fruition, and they're falling off my tree. Wondering if you can just push me in the right direction. As of right now, I do not fertilize anything, maybe like the Job's sticks, but that's it. Anything else you can let me know, I'd be grateful.
Well, with the peach, Christelle, you want to take a crack first here?
So what I would say for the sticky material that you see, the droplets on the fruit, it's very possible that you have insects like aphids or something like that. There's not just aphids do that, but aphids, psyllids, things like that produce what we call honeydew. And so as they feed on the sap, and they need to feed a lot to get the nutrients that they need. And so they excrete a lot of that sugary solution. That's their feces, pretty much. And so as they do that, that drips onto whatever, the leaf, the fruit. And I don't know specifically for peach, and I would recommend to check out that extension publication we have on growing peaches and apricots and plums, I think, in Wisconsin. That's a very good one. You can find online easily. So type growing peaches in Wisconsin. I'm sure it will show up. But what you might have is something like that. You might have some aphids or some insects like that that produce the honeydew. It's not a problem by itself. The problem that that honeydew will cause is that you have this fungus that will then thrive onto that sticky sugary solution. And that can cause some blemishes on your fruit. For homeowners, that's not a big problem. It's really on the outside of the fruit. But that's something I would pay attention to. See if you have aphids on your plants that are producing that honeydew that's dripping on your peaches.
Okay, terrific. Thank you. And then just about the pears as well.
Yeah, the pears falling off. What would cause pears to, I guess, abort, maybe? Amaya?
Do you have just one pear tree? No, I do have three. So, and I was told that they kind of have to cross-pollinate. And I always get fruit on the trees, but I've not really, every once in a blue moon, I might get one, you know, and if I put like a little net underneath it, you know, to kind of hold it up and hold it on the tree, I can get it to go. But obviously that's kind of a ridiculous thing to try to do all the time.
Yeah.
Well, I'm wondering, do you get, you know, when you say they grow to what, to which size? Like, when do they drop? Do they drop when they're like, you know, like small little like pea size, or they're like bigger, like, you know, like a marble? Because that indicate.
Okay, they're probably a good 3.5 to 4 inches. They're like a miniature pear, but they're definitely about, well, I'd say 3.5, 4 inches in length.
In length.
And you don't see any other, like, you know, symptoms in the tree? You don't see any different, you know, color, or, you know, the leaves don't show any discoloration or pattern?
No, there's really no. I'm wondering, because I've never trimmed the tree, so it's a very large tree. I don't know if that would have anything to do with it.
Well, it could definitely be that, you know, you don't get enough light, and then when you get, you know, a lot of shaded fruit inside the tree, that triggers abortion of those trees to drop. But that you don't have any fruit. I mean, it would make sense if you're telling me that a lot of the fruit is dropping from the inside of the canopy, but the fruit that you have outside of the canopy should still be continue to grow. Some other things that would, you know, produce that abortion of the fruit would be either that, you know, the pollination, like poor pollination, so you get the stimulus for the fruit to start growing, but it's just kind of like a fake stimulus. It's almost like, you know, like there's going to be a baby, but it's not. And so they just like drop them because there was really not a fertilization of the ovules inside that they once have formed the seed. That could be one thing. Another thing could be, but it would be something that you will not see every year, that if you have like something like heat stress or you have a drought, that would happen, but that would be not every single year. That's why I'm curious about the cultivars that you might have, and that it might be related with something more with the pollination and the cross pollination between the different cultivars. Do they all bloom at the same time, or do you see like some have flowers? Oh, well, that when you choose cultivars that are going to cross pollinate, the most important thing is that the bloom overlaps. That's when it happens. The same for apples or any other fruit crop that needs cross pollination. So if you have three different trees that are three different cultivars, but they don't overlap in bloom, that might be your problem.
Wonderful. Okay, well, I'm all for keep trying and keep the fruit coming, so I will try a few other options. Thank you, everyone, so much. I'm so grateful. Keep up the great work.
Thank you much for calling. Appreciate your call. Well, we're having some fun talking about fruit plants on the show today. And three guests for you: Amaya Tusha, associate professor and fruit crop specialist. She's the Gutchalk Endowed Chair for Cranberry Research at UW-Madison's Department of Horticulture. Leslie Howland, assistant professor and extension specialist, fruit crops pathology in the Department of Plant Pathology. And Christelle Gadeau, associate professor in fruit crops. She's an entomologist and extension specialist in the Department of Entomology. Just a reminder again, to go to our website, wisc.edu/radio, WPR.org/Larry. Go there, click on today's show for a link to that short questionnaire that we have, because we really are hoping that you'll fill that out with what you learned and some ideas for future shows. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller here talking fruit with our guests from the University of Wisconsin-Madison, Amaya Atucha, associate professor and fruit crop specialist, Leslie Holland, assistant professor and extension specialist in fruit crops pathology in the Department of Plant Pathology, and Christelle Gadeau, who is an associate professor and fruit crop entomologist. So questions for them. Lines, so I think there's one open line at 800-642-1234, email to ideas@wpr.org. Rahul in Oregon, we'll go to you first. Thank you for calling. What's on your mind?
Hi, a couple of quick questions. I have a rather large blackberry patch and then another raspberry patch close by. And I also have a plethora of chickens and chicken manure. So in the spring, when I clean out the coop, I threw the manure compost material around the plants. I'm wondering if there's a more efficient way of doing it, or is it more beneficial to do it, or you tell me, when they're producing fruit, when they're flowering, at the end of the season, what is the most efficient method? And then just a quick question, too, about eradicating Japanese beetles that are getting into my apple trees. And I don't have a problem with spraying some toxic substance on there, just as long as it doesn't get into the fruit. And thank you very much.
That's an issue. Maybe, Christelle, do you want to handle the insect part of it first?
Sure. I'll be happy to talk about Japanese beetle in your apple. So one thing I would say, and I understand that you're willing to spray something, what I would say is that Japanese beetle don't really affect the fruit. They're really feeding on the foliage in apple and in other crops. So not all of them. As we know, they feed on a lot of different plants. But in apple, they feed on the foliage primarily. And as you know, they'll start at the canopy of your tree. What I would say is that before you apply an insecticide, harsh, organic, whichever one people are interested, what their comfort level is with their insecticide spray, is that apple trees can probably tolerate a lot of defoliation more than we feel like cosmetically is acceptable, right? So if you're
Raul, did you have apple tree? Was it apples?
Apples. I noticed that too, that the beetles are just attacking the foliage. They're not attacking the fruit.
But
The more beetles,
Go ahead.
The more beetles in on my apple trees, the more that head to my garden. So.
Okay. So the question is, are you wanting to protect your apple tree so that you don't have any issues with your apple? Or are you trying to do that so they don't go into your raspberries?
Probably both.
Okay. So what I would say is that for the most part, I wouldn't worry so much about Japanese beetle if you in the apple tree, because you're going to need a lot of damage before you see any impact on your apples. Now, the more Japanese beetle you have, the more Japanese beetle you have, right? They're aggregating, they're bringing more in. So I wouldn't worry about spraying, is what I'm trying to say, your apple trees to protect your apple. If you're willing to spray something because you don't want to have Japanese beetle in general and you want to protect your whole entire garden and you have other plants like the raspberries and things like that, then there are products that you can spray. There's a nice publication from Extension on what insecticide you can spray for Japanese beetle adults. There are different things you can spray. I'm not going to list them all. One that I would say people can use that's pretty non-toxic would be kaolin clay. So it makes everything look white, but that's a deterrent for Japanese beetle. So that could help in deterring them from coming into your crop in the first place. For apple, it's used for sunburn. So that's something you can do to deter them from coming a little bit in your apple trees. If you wanted to spray, then there's a lot of insecticides that are, from broad spectrum to more more selective insecticide that you can spray. So I would look at the garden store for an insecticide that you could spray. Something like 7, for example, is something that would kill them. But again, you have to remember that you spray, you kill what's on there, you have a little bit of residual activity, but more will come in after. So that's always kind of short-lived. And so that's kind of where I go with that, is I don't recommend really to spray. And you can take a lot of defoliation. They help you in pruning,
Okay. And chicken manure?
Amaya, you want to jump in on that?
Yeah, that chicken manure, are you composting it or are you just thinking about applying it directly?
No, so what I do is in the chicken coop is I put down straw and some pine chip bedding that's used for horses, and it basically composts itself by the end of the winter. So I take it out and throw it right around the canes.
Okay, well, I would be careful with that because you say it composts itself. Like to really get fully composted manure, you need to get high temperatures. It needs to get to like 140 to 160 Fahrenheit. So I will be surprised if that happens in the middle of the winter. So my recommendation would be, it's great that you're mixing it with that, but then just pile it up and make sure that you need to get to that temperature inside the pile of the manure. If not, it's not composted. And the problem with that is that if you're applying it like that, there's a lot of ammonia and you could potentially burn your roots with that. So that's one of the issues. The other issue is just overall the fact that there could be a lot of pathogens in there, like affecting, like especially for human, like E. coli or all sort of other things that I will be very concerned if you put it on your blackberries. So you need to make sure that you're fully composting it. I've seen a lot of damage lately from growers that have used a lot of compost that has not been fully finished, and seen a lot of damage to plants, whether it's like strawberries or raspberries. And so be careful with that. You need to make sure that it's fully composted before you apply it. Okay. And the best time to apply it would be in the spring before the canes start growing.
Okay.
All right. Excellent.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Listener emailed to ask, what are the little white feathery bugs everywhere this year? Are they a threat to fruit bushes or trees? White feathery bugs, Christelle. Yeah, that may be just too hard to answer.
There's a couple things that come to mind. I don't know. I haven't seen anything in particular that was more than previous years. So that's the part that's a little bit puzzling to me. Maybe midges. I don't know if that would be what it is. They have feathery antennae and you see them everywhere and they're, I mean, there's been a lot, but not more than usual, at least here in the area. So I'm not sure. I might need a little bit more description on that one.
Gianni and Montello, let's go to you. Hi, Gianni.
Yes, good morning. Hey, I have a question about lingonberries. I spent some time in Sweden, and my relatives took me out lingonberry picking on the forest floor. My question is there is that genus or a similar genus or a species native to North America as well? I don't know. I haven't seen it or heard of it.
Oh, let's see. Amaya, let's go to you. I was just thinking about lingonberries because I had quite a batch of lingonberries in Door County here not too long ago at Al Johnson's Swedish Resort, as a matter of fact, his restaurant. But Amaya, what do you think?
Well, lingonberries are actually closely related with cranberries. They're also vaccinium species. And my understanding is that they are, and you know, I don't know a lot about lingonberries, but what I do know is that I think they are native from like the northern hemisphere, like somewhere like in Russia, also Canada and Alaska. You can find some wild lingonberry there. And it's not exactly the same overlap with cranberries, but we do also see some cranberry wild populations in Alaska. I think that lingonberry, there's more wild lingonberries in northern Europe that we find here.
Yeah, I'm not sure. I think that, I was trying to remember, I think that there have been attempts to grow them commercially, or at least for Al Johnson's restaurant in northern Wisconsin.
Actually, and we've had little success here in spite of our acidic, you know, we had to ask, you know, acidify the soil in that because I believe that's what they like. But we had little success with lingon here in Marquette County.
They are similar in their requirements to what cranberries and blueberries like. So the acidic soil is definitely one of them. They tend to be pretty cold hardy. There have been some ideas and attempts to use lingonberry as a possible cross with cranberries to use some of their genetic traits and incorporate that to make hybrids between both of them. But yeah, we don't have an industry for lingonberries. They look actually pretty different from cranberries, and the way that you grow them is more like as a little bush. So everything that is, you know, implemented on a larger scale and mechanization for a crop like cranberry is not necessarily applicable for lingonberries. And I think maybe that's one of the reasons why it's not a big of an industry, because you need to find new management and understand like how to harvest and do all of those things that are mechanized for some crops and not for others. And that is a lot of labor and a high cost of production.
Excuse me. Thanks very much. Gee, I'm losing my voice here suddenly. Let's take another call. Cal in Sugar Camp. Hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I was wondering if you ladies know anything about this new variety of raspberry called strawberry shortcake. It's like a bushy raspberry and it's thornless, and it's touted as being, you can grow it in a pot. But I was wondering about its viability here in Wisconsin. I'm up in northern Wisconsin, I'm north of Rhinelander, and I would like to know how successful this new variety is here in Wisconsin. I mean, I can put it in the ground. It doesn't have to stay in a pot. But I just wanted to know what you guys knew about it.
Okay. Let's see. Amaya, do you want to take that?
I actually know that there's some of these. I think that most of them have been developed on the West Coast. So I would be concerned of, like, if you're having it in the ground, if you're planting it in the ground for cold damage. That would be one of the things that I would be concerned. And I don't really know exactly what, I would assume that, you know, you're not growing it as a fall raspberry, which you remove all of the canes so that you kind of like bypass the fact that they have to overwinter, but rather you're keeping those canes through the winter so that the same canes will have flowers early in the spring. And then you would have some raspberries early in the summer. Not like the traditional way that we grow them here, that is that we cut down all of the canes in the winter so so that the following year you have to have all of the canes regrowth, and then you have flower in the late summer, and then you harvest your fruit in the fall. So the fact that they have to overwinter might be one of the constraints if you're going to establish them in the ground and not keep it in the pot, that you could potentially put them in your garage during the winter and protect them.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you.
All right. Thanks very much. Bill emailed those furry bugs we were talking about a minute ago. Bill thinks it might be a type of aphid that flies around and looks like a tiny bit of cotton. He says they're having a banner year in the Oregon area. Kyle thinks they might be the woolly alder aphids. He's seen quite a few around, and they are kind of pretty neat looking, Christelle.
You know, I haven't seen them, so that's interesting. I would love to come and see them. I would strongly suggest to ask PJ Leash, our insect diagnostician, if you send him a picture. So he's easy to find. He's kind of the bug guy. If you type in insect diagnostic clinic on the UW at Madison, you'll find his website. You can send him a photo, and he'll be more than happy to tell you what it is in more of a systematic way. Like, he can really check it and give you almost the species for most of everything we ask him. So I would rather have him give you an answer with a good picture than me speculating even more than I already did.
And he's on the show next week on Wednesday. So if I'm not mistaken, he'll be with us on Wednesday of next week. So there you go. Well, Chris, in Whitefish Bay, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. I planted three espaliered apple trees called Hattrick this year, and one of them is sending up suckers. And I'm wondering what to do with those safely, how to get rid of those suckers.
Where are they? They're coming from the roots?
Yeah, the right. You know, I put a mulch around it, and then the up from the roots, they're all these suckers, but only on one tree.
Amaya, what do you think?
How much mulch did you put, and is it covering the graft union?
No, not covering the graft. Mm-mm. No.
Do you know what rootstock you
make
have?
Make a donut. Pardon?
Do you know what rootstock you have?
The tree's called a Hattrick.
Okay,
and I don't know what
apple
it has
tree,
a certain...
When you buy an apple tree, it's actually two parts. One is the root part, and one is the scion that is the one that is going to grow and form the entire canopy. And that's the Hattrick cultivar. But the part that produces the roots is called a rootstock, and there's different types, and they confer different fruit size. Some of them can be resistant to some diseases, and there are also some of them are resistant to some insect pests. So some of the rootstocks will produce more suckers than others. So it might just be that you might have some of those rootstocks that will produce more of them. Now, what's the solution here is to just prune out those suckers. The best time is to do it during the summer. That really debilitates them. If you wait until the winter, what's going to happen is that you're going to keep getting more and more regrowth of suckers. And so I would advise you to cut them off now.
Okay. And then what do I do? Is there anything to prevent them from growing?
No, this is a genetic trait. You're going to have to be battling with them.
That's okay. They're small little espaliered trees. They're fine. I don't mind it. I just didn't know when the best time to deal with those are. And then when those apples come with little spots on them, is there a way to make the apple look perfect or more? I actually have them just for ornamental purposes. But
yeah, Leslie? Anything?
Yeah, if they're just for ornamental, I get them wanting to look nice. A lot of the spots you end up getting on apple, with the exception of a few, are really just more aesthetically, you know, uncomfortable for a lot of folks, but for edible fruits, they're still fine to eat. I think there's bagging methods that folks use that might be more for insects to kind of prevent insect feeding damage, but the same thing oftentimes goes for a lot of those fungal spores that would make contact with the fruit anyway. So you could try that, or, you know, take a new approach or vantage point to how those fruits look. So...
Okay, thank you.
All right, thanks, Chris. Frank in Green Bay, your turn.
Hi, I have a Josterberry, which is about 6 foot high and 8 feet wide. The plant is doing well, but it's not fruiting well. and I think I need to really thin it out and prune it back, which I've not been doing. When should I do that? The books seem to say I have to do it in the middle of winter when it's going to be covered with snow. So is it okay to do it in the fall? The gooseberries and blackcurrants that I've got growing in the same area are doing well and fruiting.
Amaya, what do you think?
Well, there's two. You can prune them in the winter, but I would say that maybe the best way to the best timing of pruning it is during the spring when things start warming up and you have obviously, you know, the soil starts warming up before you start seeing any activity, before you start seeing buds start swelling. That's the time to prune it. It's very safe to prune in the spring. Usually for commercial settings, growers will have to start pruning really early on in the middle of the winter if they want to go through all of the acres that they have. But if you're just a homeowner, the best time to prune is actually in the spring before you start seeing any growth. That is a very safe time to prune. And you know, it's actually more enjoyable pruning in the spring than having to prune in the middle of January. Also, when you prune in the middle of the winter and it's really, really cold, you sometimes get a little bit of dieback just because it desiccates where you have the cut. And so, yeah, I would say, you know, any time in April or like late April, you should be fine. Even if you see active growth, you can still prune.
Is it okay to prune it quite hard?
Yes, it is fine. And what I would recommend is instead of cutting back the top portion of the shoots, just remove entire shoots. Just thin out some of those shoots instead of just like cutting the top portion of them. And you can remove many canes. I mean, if you remove, you know, maybe 40% of the canopy, you're going to be just fine.
Thank you.
Frank, thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to get one more plug in here for our survey, our extension survey. We're partnering with UW-Madison to learn more about your experiences listening to Garden Talk. Love to have you fill out a little questionnaire. It'll take you 1 or 2 minutes. And it'll ask you a couple of questions about what you learned during the show and also ask you for some ideas for future Garden Talk topics. So just go to WPR.org/Larry, WPR.org/Larry, and click on today's show note for a link. It is always such a pleasure to talk fruits with you folks, and I appreciate it very much. Leslie, welcome. Thank you so much for being with us today. Leslie Holland, Amaya Tucha, and Christelle Godot. They've been doing it for a long time. And Leslie, we hope you'll be doing it for a long time down the road, too. So thank all three of you. Appreciate it very, very much. Just a look ahead. Our physical therapists are going to be back to talk about getting the most from your physical therapy visit. That's Monday, starting at 11 on the Ideas Network. Stay with us right through the afternoon. Lots more in store. On the Ideas Network, I'm Larry Mueller.